Department of Mathematics and Physics at the University of Salento, Italy. They concluded that Collins and Hale were correct, and that on the northern side of their orientations, the central pillars of the studied enclosures are in fact turned to face the setting of Deneb. Lorenzis and Orofino refined the dates given by Collins and Hale, pushing them back by about 200 years, but agreed that subtle changes in the orientation of the enclosures were evidence of the tracking of precession. Astrophysicist Juan Antonio Belmonte also looked at the astronomical characteristics of Göbekli Tepe. He noted that amongst the circular enclosures there is one with nearly rectangular walls, which were almost perfectly aligned to the cardinal points. Needless to say, such exact alignments, as at the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt, cannot have been achieved without the use of equally exact astronomical observations. Belmonte also paid attention to the profuse decoration of the T-pillars at Göbekli Tepe, concluding that these may represent yet other astronomical observations, such as the crescent and the star, so common in later cultures of the Middle East. Then there are what could be interpreted as totemic representations of animals, which, if we may continue to speculate, could symbolize constellations such as Leo, Taurus, and Scorpio. This is the right moment to deal with Klaus Schmidt's argument that there couldn't possibly be any astronomical figures at Göbekli Tepe because the zodiac constellations were not recognized until Babylonian times, 9,000 years after Göbekli Tepe. I didn't challenge him on this point when I interviewed him because I was more interested in hearing his own views on Göbekli Tepe rather than engaging him in a possibly acrimonious debate. Clearly, however, Belmonte, who knows his stuff, does not agree with the position taken by Schmidt. Neither, for that matter, does the Russian astronomer and historian of science, Alexander Gerstein, who traces the first recognition and naming of constellations, notably the Great Bear, to 20,000 BC, and more detailed knowledge of the zodiac, to the epoch of 5,600 BC. German archaeoastronomer Michael Rappengluck pushes the origins of the zodiac even further back than that, however. He has identified an accurate depiction of the zodiacal constellation of Taurus, painted more than 17,000 years ago in the Hall of Bulls in Lascaux Cave in France. Rappengluck points out that there are four key moments of the year: the spring equinox, the autumn equinox, the winter solstice, and the summer solstice. We've seen already how the character of a world age has long been thought to be governed by the zodiacal constellation that houses the sun on the spring equinox. But other constellations also house the other three prominent stations of the sun at the autumn equinox and at the summer and winter solstices. And when a shift of age takes place, with one constellation giving way to another on the spring equinox, so the constellations governing the other three stations also shift. There is not space to go into the evidence in detail here, but the essence of Rappengluck's argument concerning Lascaux is that depicted there is the whole constellation of Taurus in one of the aurochs, or bull figures in the Hall of Bulls, and also above its shoulder, in a distinctive pattern of six dots, the six visible stars of the Pleiades, which form a highly recognizable element of Taurus. Moreover, a date can be put on this depiction. Rappengluck points out that the Pleiades, in 15,300 BC, were very near the point of the autumn equinox. The six stars in the Salle des Taureaux, therefore, represents a striking and excellent heavenly marker for the beginning of autumn. The epoch calculated astronomically lies extraordinarily close to the carbon-14 dating for human activity in this part of the cave, corresponding to 15,300 BC. In other work, Rappengluck provides further compelling evidence that our ancestors, at least as early as the epoch between 16,000 BC and 10,000 BC, recognized single and very complex star patterns, including the Milky Way, the Northern Crown in the cave of El Castillo in Spain, the Pleiades in the cave of Lascaux, France, and the main constellations of the sky at the same location. He also documents a rock panel in the cave of La Tête du Lion, France, that shows the combination of a star pattern, Aldebaran in the bull and the Pleiades, with a drawing of the moon cycle above. The picture comes from the Solutrean epoch, around 19,000 to 20,000 BC. It shows not only a remarkable similarity with the representation in the Lascaux cave, but clearly connects the star pattern with part of the lunar cycle. Rappenglück's conclusion, and again I must cut a long story short, is that hunter-gatherers of Paleolithic epochs looked up to the starry sky and saw the open cluster of the Pleiades with the wandering moon and sun near or between the Golden Gate of the Ecliptic, 21,000 years ago. The Golden Gate of the Ecliptic that Rappenglück refers to here was traditionally conceived of as that area of the heavens bounded by the Hyades and the Pleiades, both of which are star groups within the constellation of Taurus, between which, as though through a great celestial gate, the ecliptic passes. The ecliptic is the technical term for the sun's perceived path through the heavens. The implication, therefore, is that the path of the sun and the moon, against the background of the constellations of the zodiac, was observed, depicted, and understood in the Paleolithic, perhaps as much as 10,000 years before Göbekli Tepe was built. For this reason, Belmonte makes a point of citing Rappenglück's work, and indeed of showing a photo provided by Rappenglück of the Taurus figure in the Hall of Bulls at Lascaux, when he makes his seemingly off-the-cuff remark that zodiacal constellations such as Leo, Taurus, and Scorpio might be the inspiration for the totemic animals depicted at Göbekli Tepe. For Belmonte, in summary, Göbekli Tepe offers evidence that a completely unknown hunter-gatherer society more than 11,000 years ago sought to create monumental structures linked to the heavens. This series of sanctuaries, built presumably one after the other and even one upon another, may have been used for centuries, perhaps millennia, to chart the heavens. However, for reasons which are unknown, the constructors deliberately buried the structures, creating conditions which contributed to their excellent state of preservation, despite their great antiquity. Certainly, the indigenous inhabitants of the Göbekli Tepe area were hunter-gatherers, and completely unknown hunter-gatherers at that. But it has been my thesis throughout this book that their sudden venture into spectacular monumental architecture, closely followed by their equally spectacular invention of agriculture, is very strange. Indeed, it amounts to an almost inexplicable great leap forward that cries out for a coherent explanation which archaeology has yet to provide. The hypothesis we are exploring here, and that I believe might explain these anomalies, is that the survivors of a lost civilization, who had already mastered agriculture and knew everything there was to know about building with megaliths, had settled amongst the hunter-gatherers of Göbekli Tepe following the Younger Dryas cataclysm and transferred some of their skills to them. Now, in addition to megalithic architecture and agriculture, we must take the evidence of astronomy into account. At first sight, while the work of Belmonte, Collins, Hale, Schock, Magli, and others confirms that competent astronomers must have been at work at Göbekli Tepe, we cannot say that the level of knowledge manifested in the alignments of the pillars and enclosures was necessarily that of a sophisticated civilization. We've seen from the research done by Gerstein and Rappenglück that careful observations of the sky and identification of constellations we can still recognize today can be traced back into the Neolithic and beyond that, into the art of the painted caves of the Paleolithic, 20,000 or more years ago. So expressions of such knowledge at Göbekli Tepe need not surprise us unduly. But suppose there was something else, something that hunter-gatherers, no matter how savvy, could not be expected to have known under any circumstances. It is that elusive something else that Paul Burley's work brought home to me like a shot of adrenaline when I reread his paper in my hotel room in San Liorfa in July 2014. Neolithic Puzzle. Burley's paper is entitled Göbekli Tepe, Temples Communicating an Ancient Cosmic Geography. He wrote it originally in June 2011, I met him at the Conference of Precession and Ancient Knowledge in Sedona, Arizona, in September that year. We exchanged a couple of emails during 2012, and in February 2013, he asked me to read his paper, which he said concerned evidence of a zodiac on one of the pillars at Göbekli Tepe. I read it, replied that I found it very persuasive and interesting with significant implications, and told him I'd like to publish it on the articles page of my website. Paul agreed, and the article went live on the 8th of March 2013. It's still there, accessible through the URL provided in the note. Significant implications, I now realize as I read through the paper again in my hotel room in San Liorfa, was a huge understatement. But I didn't make my first visit to Göbekli Tepe until September 2013, and by then clearly I'd forgotten the gist of Burley's argument, which focuses almost exclusively on Enclosure D and on the very pillar, Pillar 43, that I'd been most interested in when I was there. My interest in it had been sparked by Belmonte's suggestion that the relief carving of a scorpion near its base, which the reader will recall was hidden by rubble that Schmidt refused to allow me to move, might be a representation of the zodiacal constellation of Scorpio. So it was a lapse on my part not to have reread Burley's paper documenting a zodiac on the same pillar before I travelled to the site. But we're all human. We all make mistakes, we all forget things, and despite acknowledging its significant implications in our correspondence 6 months earlier, what Burley had discovered had slipped my mind entirely on my September 2013 visit. Here's where he gets to his point. One of the limestone pillars in Enclosure D includes a scene in bas-relief on the upper portion of one of its sides. There is a bird with outstretched wings, two smaller birds, a scorpion, a snake, a circle, and a number of wavy lines and cord-like features. At first glance, this lithified menagerie appears to be simply a hodgepodge of animals and geometrical designs randomly placed to fill in the broadside of the pillar. The key to unlocking this early Neolithic puzzle is the circle situated at the center of the scene. I am immediately reminded, Burley wrote, of the cosmic father, the sun. The next clues are the scorpion facing up towards the sun, and the large bird seemingly holding the sun upon its outstretched wing. In fact, the sun figure appears to be located accurately on the ecliptic with respect to the familiar constellation of Scorpio, although the scorpion on the pillar occupies only the left portion or head of our modern conception of that constellation. As such, the sun symbol is located as close to the galactic center as it can be on the ecliptic as it crosses the galactic plane. Bear with me, and I'll explain all this. Meanwhile, let's continue with Burley's article because it's his next statement that really has me sitting up and paying attention. What's important here, he wrote, is for some unknown reason, the builders of Göbekli Tepe constructed a temple apparently highlighting a time 11,600 years in their future. Yet this scene is intentional. Symbolism is clear and in keeping with many mythologies describing this very same event, occurring at the very time we live in today. Burley then presents a graphic that illustrates the crossing of the galactic plane of the Milky Way near the center of the galaxy, with several familiar constellations nearby. A second graphic shows the same view, with the addition of the ancient constellations represented on the pillar. Note, wrote Burley, that the outstretched wings, sun, bird legs, and snake all appear to be oriented to emphasize the sun's path along the ecliptic. The similarity of the bas relief to the crossing of the ecliptic and the galactic equator at the center of the Milky Way is difficult to reject, supporting the possibility that humans recognized and documented the precession of the equinoxes thousands of years earlier than is generally accepted by scholars. Göbekli Tepe was built as a symbolic sphere, communicating a very ancient understanding of world and cosmic geography. Why this knowledge was intentionally buried soon afterward remains a mystery. I don't immediately understand everything that Burley is saying in all this, but I understand enough to get started on it, and fortunately I have astronomy software, Stellarium, on my computer that can simulate the ancient skies, taking account of precession. More importantly, the program can show me the sky of our own time, and will allow me to scroll through it day by day, month by month, going forward or back as I wish, enlarging and inspecting any specific elements that I'm interested in. Most often I study ancient skies, not modern one. But tonight it's our own time I need to take a look at, or rather, not exactly our own time, July 2014 as I sit in front of my computer in Sanliurfa, but a year and a half earlier, the winter solstice, the 21st of December 2012, the much-hyped end date that passed with not so much as a whimper, let alone a bang, of the famous Mayan calendar. Message on a pillar? Here's what I'm aware of already as I open Stellarium on my computer. When Paul Burley talks about the sun depicted on the Göbekli Tepe pillar being located as close to the galactic center as it can be on the ecliptic, and when he also makes a point of telling me that Scorpio is involved, I know he can only be referring to one epoch, the epoch of the year 2000, give or take a maximum of about 40 years on either side, in other words, from 1960 to 2040. The great band of stars and clouds of interstellar dust arching across the sky that we call the Milky Way, and that is in fact our own home galaxy viewed edge-on, is crossed by the ecliptic, in other words, the sun's apparent path through the heavens, twice a year. One of these gigantic interchanges is in the north, between the constellations of Gemini and Taurus. In our epoch, the sun stands here at the northern hemisphere's summer solstice, that is around the 21st of June. The second interchange is in the south, between the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio. And in our epoch, the sun stands here at the northern hemisphere's winter solstice, in other words, around the 21st of December. The reader will recall that precession has the visual effect, as viewed from Earth, of causing the constellations that house the sun at the four key moments of the year, the two equinoxes and the two solstices, to shift very slowly around the belt of the zodiac, with the sun spending 2,160 years in each zodiacal constellation at each key moment, before the whole system slips round far enough for the sun to have passed completely from one constellation into another. When this happens at the equinox, it happens at the other three stations as well. Indeed, it's a good mental exercise to imagine a circle, which represents the ecliptic, in other words, the annual path of the sun, and to mark out at equal intervals around the circumference of this circle the 12 constellations of the zodiac. Now place four spokes, arranged in the form of a cross, inside the circle. Where each of the four ends of the cross touch the edge of the circle, you have one of the key stations of the sun. The Northern Hemisphere's spring equinox, 21st of March, summer solstice, 21st of June, autumn equinox, 21st of September, and winter solstice, 21st of December. In our epoch, the zodiacal constellations housing the sun at these four stations are Pisces on the March equinox, Gemini on the June solstice, Virgo on the September equinox, and Sagittarius on the December solstice. However, precession has the effect of very slowly rotating the spokes of the cross. We are nearing the end of the age of Pisces now, in other words, of the 2,160 years when Pisces houses the sun on the March equinox. And the end of the spoke that was in Pisces will soon rotate into Aquarius, hence the song, "We live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius." But because the cross is, if you like, welded together to form a single fixed unit, all its spokes must move together, with the result that as the March equinox shifts from Pisces into Aquarius, so the June solstice will shift from Gemini into Taurus, the September equinox from Virgo into Leo, and the December solstice from Sagittarius into Scorpio. I want to avoid undue complications as far as possible here, but let us now return to the Milky Way, which, as we've seen, is crossed by the path of the sun twice a year. Remember that at each crossing point, a pair of zodiacal constellations sits on either side of the Milky Way, effectively forming the pillars of two celestial gates through which the road of the Milky Way passes, Gemini and Taurus in the north, with the Sun